Listening Dog Media. Music, sport, history. Stories from the people of the city. The Manc Made Podcast with Jack Wood.
Hello and welcome to the Manc Made Podcast. I'm Jack Wood and cheers for downloading this one. A right treat for you. We are chatting to Justin Morehouse, a name that should be well known to anyone in the northern area, really, if you can't quite put it to a face. Phoenix Knights, young Kenny, the guy who got his face painted as a tiger. That chap, yes. We find all about how Justin got into the comedy scene relatively late, some might say at the age of 29, and how within 18 months he was a TV name in a way. So yeah, it can happen to you, it can happen to him. So let's sit down and have a chat about his highs and lows of his career, really. First of all, thanks for popping on, Justin. Really appreciate it, man.
It's okay. It's not like I've got anything else to do.
It's been so much easier getting guests for that exact reason.
I know.
Brilliant.
It's like I do that all the time. People go, can you do this? And I go, let me just check my diary. Oh, yeah, I can.
Yeah, it just says Corona constantly all the way through.
There's the old comics joke in the 60s and 70s. They used to say, things aren't going well. I got snow blindness when I opened my diary the other day.
I guess it sort of feels like that at the moment, but that's what I wanted to talk about a little bit, how you sort of got into comedy, because you started comedy, well, I guess there's not relative, but some would say relatively late. Your first gig was 29, right?
Yeah, I mean, I look back now and I feel a bit silly for thinking this, but at 29 I thought my life was mapped out and that was it, and that's where it was going to be, and I was going to be doing this job that I didn't really like doing. And I always felt I had some kind of creative urge, but I wasn't very artistic at anything, really. Can't sing, I can't play any musical instruments, and I can't draw, I can't paint. And I just thought, well, what am I going to do with my life? And I just meandered around, really. And I used to love stand-up comedy. I used to go and watch a lot of stand-up comedy. And then it was literally, I was driving down the road one day and I thought, I wonder how you become a stand-up comedian. It's like, literally, I wonder how that happens. And so I rang up the Frog and Bucket and said, how do you do it? And they said, we have open mic nights and you come down. I booked myself in and that was it, at 29.
Do you remember what that first set was about? I imagine that was a lot different from how you perform now.
Yeah, there's nothing in there that's still there. It was 5 minutes. I had some... It was awful, but it worked. The worst thing I did was I said, my biggest regret is that my mum couldn't come tonight. My dad's been beavering away since 3:30.
Oh. I mean, it
was
works.
Terrible. It was terrible. And then I said, not really, no. It was my sister who was doing it. Oh, God. And I said, we're more Oedipus than Bagpuss in our house. That's what it was. It was terrible. It was really bad. But I quickly dropped that stuff. So I did three on the trot. I did 3 Mondays. So the first one was brilliant. Second one was terrible. I thought I knew what I was doing. And the third one was, it was all right. And then I thought to myself, how do you stop doing this now? How do you say I used to be a clown?
Yeah. I do a little bit of stand-up every now and again. I'm at that 5-minute open mic stage. So I guess for anyone else who's at that, how would you progress from that 5-minute doing open slots to it becoming like a career, I guess?
It's different now. So it was 20 years ago. It was very different. There's a lot more opportunity to do spots. And I just sort of fell into it. And the minute I started doing it, I absolutely loved it and just sort of threw myself into it. I was gigging 5-6 nights a week. And I had a full-time job, and I had a 1.5-year-old, and a marriage that didn't last very long, and then that kind of happened, and then I got lucky really quickly. I got a couple of big chances, took them, and because I took them, it progressed me, and that was that, and that was the City Life Comedian of the Year, which was a competition that used to be a very regular Northwest Comedian of the Year. And I just won that. I can be Big Headed 20 years later. I was head and shoulders above anybody else. It was, I knew when I'd finished that I'd won. It was just,
Yeah.
And then that night, because it was at the brand new comedy store, and that night they approached me and said, we'd like to represent you and we'd like to start putting you at the comedy store. And I was like, 18 months in, I was getting gigs at the comedy store. I mean, if that wasn't scrappy enough, I was actually filming Phoenix Nights at the same time.
So it was around this. I didn't realise that was so soon.
Yeah, it was all the
you.
Same day, same week. Yeah, it was like, because I was a bit of a Peter Kay fanboy and Johnny Vegas. I was a bit of a kind of, used to go and watch them at the Buzz and at the Frog and different places. And when I started doing stand-up, I was with Smug one day, Smug Roberts, at this place in the old Lancaster Club in, I don't know exactly what it, Failsworth or whatever the area is, New Moston. It's one of them areas, isn't it, where there's a dead long road and you don't know where one place starts and one place ends, but it's that kind of corner, Chadderton, Failsworth, whatever. Anyway, at the Lancaster Club, and Smug used to put these things on with a marquee when he'd do some training, and then he'd also do a stand-up night. And it was when Peter was just breaking through, so the place was packed, and it was, we went to watch, and we got introduced afterwards, and I said to Peter, oh, I'd love, because everybody knew he was doing something, and I said, oh, I'd love to audition for you. And he said, well, what do you mean? I said, because I'd really like to know what it's like to go for an audition. I was quite new at it. And he said, yeah, you can, because you're the first person who's asked me for an audition, not for a part. So I did that. And here's a little anecdote. That's what it's all about, isn't it? Anecdotes.
Yeah, that's what we want. We want clickbait.
At the same time, this is right. Listen how cool this is. At the same time as I went for an audition in for Phoenix Nights, I also, the day after, auditioned for Danny Boyle, okay? And when I met him, he said, you're the first person I've met to audition since Leonardo DiCaprio for The Beach, right? I think he just did that to put me at ease. And I remember one thing, they said, do you want lunch? And he said, I'll have a bacon and avocado if it's going. I thought, oh, he's not from Radcliffe anymore. This was like 1999, bacon and avocado, who are you? And then...
Setting trends.
My mate had said, like, oh, what you need to do is, like, when you go in, because he was an actor, and he said, what you need to do is you need to, like, chat to them and listen to them, and like, if they ask you to do something, you do it, and then if they ask you to do it in a different way, you do it the way they've told, because that shows you can listen to direction. When you're not an actor, it's important to be able to do what you've been told. So we were having the chat, and he did that thing. He goes, so what have you been up to since we last saw you? I was like, you've never seen him before, but it's something that they always say, isn't it? And yeah, then I said, oh, this and that and the other. He said, before we start, have you got any questions about me and my stuff? And I don't know why I did this, but I went. I said, you know your film Shallow Grave? And he said, yeah. I said, you know the bit in that film where they're burying the body and it's illuminated by the taillights? And he said, yeah. I said, you know in that film Goodfellas, where they're burying the body and it's illuminated by the taillights? And he went, yeah. I went, where does plagiarism begin and homage end? And he said, you're a cheeky cunt. That was it. Then I did the audition. I don't think that's what didn't get me the parts. I was up for two parts. Yeah. And the two parts went to Timothy Spall and Christopher Eccleston. So I don't think I missed out, really.
No. I think...
I think they went a different way.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been a completely different sort of, like, film if it was with you. I would have enjoyed it. I want to see your version.
Two TV films he made for BBC Two, and, I didn't hear back, but I got the part in Phoenix Nights, and that was a good start for me, and, a leg up.
What was auditioning like for Peter Kay? Did you read the part of Young Kenny at the time, or did that not exist? Was it written? Because it seems like everyone who seemed to play a part in Phoenix Nights brought something of themselves into that part, so...
Well, no, I don't think it wasn't. No, it wasn't written for me, and no, it wasn't.
No.
Because he was written before he met me, and... Yeah, so you just get a... Sorry, shall we then? So, yeah, you just get a bit of script, and you do it, and he goes, oh, can you do it like that? And you do it like that. And then he rang me at the night and just said, oh, like, we really want you to be in it. And I was like, oh, my God. It was like, we're going to Hollywood, you know? And I was working. I'd quit my job by then, and I was doing stand-up as much as I could, and I was doing temporary work. I used to work for the council in Ashton on their area repair team. Taking those phone calls that are literally those. I've had two of your men up my back passage all day and all that sort of, that sort of
good,
stuff.
And good material.
Yeah, and then I walked in one day and I said, I said, hey, I'm not coming in again. And they went, why? And I went, because I got a part in a TV show.
Ooh.
And they went, wow. And then 6 weeks later, I was out of work. I wish I'd gone back. But yeah, so then that, and then I never looked back from that, really. I think it afforded me, you know, some opportunities and chances, along with the comedy store thing. And I just grafted, really. That's what I've always done. I've always, you know, I've always appreciated the chances that I get, because I do get some good chances. Appreciate those. And you have to take them when you can and run with them, I think.
I've got to ask about the Phoenix Knights thing. How did it feel as a Red to be wearing a Man City shirt constantly throughout that process?
Well, this is a question that gets asked very often, and I've told this story a number of times, and it's simply this. It's like, I am a United fan, you know, and the character was an absolute dingbat. And they didn't want him to be a Bolton fan because they had a scene with a load of Bolton fans in it, so they were making sure it was very different. And they said, oh, who do you support? I said, United. They said, oh, we'll get a United shirt. And I went, nah, he's an idiot. He'd be a City fan, this guy.
So I chose it.
I chose it because, I mean, I think he's more of a City fan than he would be a United fan anyway. Mm. He's a lovable loser, isn't he? He's kind of that. And at that time, that's what City were, you know. I mean, he'd probably be a United fan now, but look at me talking like he's got a backstory.
Well, you went into depth, mate.
Yeah, and so, yeah, that was it. And then I used to get, for a while then, I would get people going, like, you're a Blue, aren't you? And I go, no, I'm a United fan. They go, why do you wear that then? It's Phoenix Knights. I was like, you know, Doctor Who doesn't travel in time. You know?
Yeah, blew their minds.
Yeah, it's, you know, Julie Roberts is not a sex worker. You know that's a fact, right?
And the first I've heard of it.
Doesn't eat people. You know what I mean? It's a part I was playing, and it goes to show how well I did it, that they believed it was really me. But I was at the Derby once at United, opened the programme, and in the Welcome to Our Neighbours section, big picture of me in a City shirt. I was like, what's going on now? And they went, oh no, he's a United fan. I was like, don't put that in the programme.
When you were sort of filming Phoenix Knights, though, was there a sense that it was going to become this, like, iconic thing, or was it just a bit of a laugh?
Well, what you have to take into account is that Peter was on the crest of that wave, and he was, you know, tipping into superstardom, so we were well aware of that. One of my favourite things about that time was that Peter was so well known around Bolton that he couldn't knock about, he couldn't walk, you know, he was famous there then. And one day when we were having the catering and everything, and he said, I'm sick of this, he said, shall we go to Chippy? And I pushed him in the wheelchair dressed as Brian to the Chippy, and no one recognised him because no one had seen it yet. It was great, that. So, yeah. But we had this, we knew it was funny because, you know, Peter's really funny and Dave's really funny and Neil's really funny, and they'd written this very, very funny thing. And we all made each other laugh and we had a nice time doing it. But we didn't, you know, you could just, you know, we didn't know it would have the longevity it's had and the kind of classic status it's got. People, you know, when people like it, they absolutely love it. It's up there with those kind of, I'm not saying it's as popular as, but it's got that same kind of cachet, hasn't it, as With Nail and I and, you know, Spinal Tap and, you know, people quote it. And, you know, I get mostly in the summer, I get loads of pictures of people going on stag do's dressed as the characters, you know. Yeah. And it's just, people absolutely love it. There's a lot of warmth for it, and it's got that cult thing, but it's not cult, it's kind of broad, you know, it's got a broad appeal as well. It's really you know what, it's a lovely thing to have had a small part in something so great. It's, you know, it's people, when you get interviewed on, like, you know, Radio Berkshire because you're trying to sell some tickets in Maidenhead, yeah, you go, really sorry, but I'm going to have to talk to you about Phoenix Knights. And I go, don't be sorry. That's why I've got a chance to be on Radio Berkshire, you know. It's like sometimes I've interviewed people on Radio Manchester and they go, I don't want to talk about what I did in Emmerdale. And I go, I don't think anyone's really that arsed about that one woman played in about vaginas at the Contact. They're listening to you because you were in Emmerdale. That's why we've got you on. And then we'll mention what you're doing as well.
But speaking of soaps, you pop up in Corrie, don't you, as the DJ voice?
I've been in Corrie three times. So
three times.
I delivered a car once to Sally Webster as a car salesman. That was a funny little job. And then about 4 years ago, I was played the landlord of the Flying Horse. Dean Upton. And he, technically, I think he's still the landlord. So I think I'm still the landlord of the Flying Horse in Rosamond Street. And I did three or four eps then. And then I they had a last year, Mary was doing a radio phone-in and I recorded the DJ asking the questions, yeah. So
nice.
Three times. I'd love to be in Corrie. I love it. It's great.
I mean, what else? Like, I mean, it's the Northern Institution sort of thing, isn't it, really? You've got Phoenix Nights, you've got Corrie under your belt. What's next? Is it sort of like...
Yeah, well, I don't know. This, the Manc-Made Podcast.
There you go. You've made it on it, finally.
Yeah, yeah.
it's what they always say. But did you have any acting training before you went into Phoenix Nights? Because it sounded like an 18-month period, you just went for it and just said yes to everything and it sort of just worked.
Yeah, and there wasn't much to do, you know, stand there, look gormless, say three words. I mean, it's what I do in life, you know what I mean? So, no, it was, and then the two occasions where I did have a lot to do, I couldn't do it, you know. So, very famously, they're the outtakes where you see I just crumble for about an hour and a half. So, no training. And I look back sometimes and think when I was a kid, you know, it may have been interesting to have gone to drama school or gone a different way, and people go, well, you wouldn't be, you know, wouldn't be where you are now. And I go, well, no, but we don't know where you'd have been. I really like the acting and the sort of theatre stuff, and you know, that's the, you know, that's, it's a real skill to learn. And when, like, I've done a couple of plays, and that process of learning the script and rehearsing it and getting into character and trying to understand the nuances of the play, and because I've been at the Royal Exchange, so they're also in the Round as well, and that sort of thing. It, without being too artistically wanky, that helps you as a comedian, and being a comedian helps you be an actor, and all those things feed into them. And so I know that my stand-up comedy is improved by being, you know, doing some important plays. I know that my presentation and my poise and timing and delivery and doing nothing sometimes on stage when you're a stand-up is very important, just doing nothing. And we're frightened of that because we think we're not getting a laugh. You know, waiting for the laugh and things like that, that's what's taught me. When, if 700 people are there watching you, they know it's going to be all right. No one's panicking for 10 seconds.
No.
And sometimes as a comedian, you got to get the jokes out quick, and sometimes you just need to let them breathe and allow them to be bigger than they are.
Yeah, I guess, like, but when you're on stage, 10 seconds can feel like an eternity to let something breathe.
Yeah, it can. I mean, but there's some favourite moments where you deliberately make it awkward. I've got a couple of bits in my set now where I deliberately send an audience down a path of feeling uncomfortable, but I control that. That's an interesting thing, is to control an audience to make them feel edgy and then puncture it. You know, we've blown the balloon up so that you can just feel it, you know, when the balloon's, you know, is just, and instead of banging it, we just let it down. And it's a nice thing to do. I enjoy those moments on stage more than just, you know, joke, funny, finger to buy a skip, blah, 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 you know. Yeah. I enjoy those storytelling bits.
Well, you've been, like, since you started the comedy, it sounds like you haven't stopped at any point, and it sounds like the passion's constantly been there.
Mm-hmm.
What has kept you drawn to the live stand-up more than anything else, really? Like, it sounds like you've never lost passion for it.
Because that's what I am.
Yeah.
I'm a stand-up comedian that is lucky to get to do the radio and a bit of acting and to do some, you know, hosting awards and all the things that pay the bills. But if I wasn't a stand-up comedian, I couldn't do any of those things. And I think sometimes when you do well at something else and you leave the comedy to one side, you get flabby and it's difficult. It's like starting again. Like Jay Leno, when he was, you know, hosting the biggest TV show in the world, you know, The Late Show, whatever it was called, and he was The Tonight Show, he was still, like, on stage three nights a week in LA, you know, still doing that. You know, that's what he did.
It's a muscle.
It is a muscle. And it's also, you know, what I notice when I see some of my friends who are, like, successful, you know, started at the same time as me and my peer group, and they come back to stand-up and they haven't done it for a while. You know, they've done an 18-month tour and sold hundreds of thousands of tickets. And when they start again, they're 18 months behind everybody. They're a little bit off the pace, and they kind of don't, they're not in tune with audiences, and the audiences change, and people, only so slightly, and it's you know, impenetrable to understand how an audience is, but unless you're doing it every night, you can get a feel of how they are. You know, people who weren't doing jokes about Brexit through Brexit and then coming and doing jokes now are not understanding audiences' reaction.
Yeah,
like Alan Cochran always says that thing, he says, a comic says to him, he goes, was doing my Brexit stuff, and half the audience didn't like it. Of course.
Yeah.
You know, that's the very nature of what's happened, you know what I mean?
I thought that was a joke then. I thought that was a genuine joke.
No, no, he was complaining, going, half of them didn't get it. He said, well, I think it might have been 52% of them didn't like it.
Yeah. Oh, man. But yeah, I mean, how are you finding, obviously, because of the pandemic that we're in at the moment, everything's halted, everything stopped, the comedy stopped. Mm-hmm. Like, how are you finding that? Like, are you doing any shows? Are you doing online? Are you sort of
done a few bits, but it's not the same. Started slowly going back now. I've done a driving gig, which was odd, but it, you know, we did it.
Was that when everyone was in cars?
Yeah.
So how did they laugh?
Well, they didn't. Well, so you just do it.
Did they not hold the horns?
They're laughing, and they at some of these gigs they'll beat the horns, but they couldn't do it where we were because they had a local noise abatement thing. So they were flashing their lights, and then one guy leant out of his car and did the kind of, like, you know, claps through the windows, which was nice to know that he was enjoying it. So that was all right. And they've sort of like petered out now, those driving gigs, because the cost of putting the bomb was so expensive. So I've done that. I've done one outdoor gig in Chester, at the back of a live music venue in the garden, which was great. It was just solid to do that. It was such a lovely feeling. And then I've done, what else have I done? I've done a few things live on Zoom and that. And then I did a bit of a festival thing on Saturday night. You know, again, you know, they're not perfect, but they're better than they are. But comedy's coming back this week now, and you know, things are opening up again, and we'll be getting there. So I'm really looking forward to that. I've really missed it. I've really found it difficult. I've really struggled with not doing it. You know, it's been a bit of a tough old time, really, for a lot of us. You know, the adrenaline's not there. You need that adrenaline to survive, and we're not using it, and it's kind of been a bit hard. Doing a radio show 4 hours a week doesn't compare, you know, and doing my own podcasts. I still try to be creative, but it's not the same.
Yeah, you're not getting that rush. I've heard, like, some comedians find it really difficult if you stop for a bit, then suddenly they still get that adrenaline rush at a certain time of night, because that's when they used to be going on stage, and then they just can't sleep. They get migraines, or they don't know what to do with that energy.
I've had a terrible time sleeping, even more so recently when I've gone back and done a couple of things and then not done, you know, it's almost like it's been reignited. I think that adrenaline and that rush, and also that, you know, we're a weird bunch of people, comedians, he says as the ambulance comes for him. We're a weird bunch of people that, like, if you go into a green room with a bunch of comedians and you're just a, you know, a member of the general public, and you see the way that comedians talk to each other, it's awful, you know. Like, do you not like each other? We go, yes, if we didn't, we wouldn't say these things. So I've missed that. So to be in the company of my, you know, my mates, and that's been the nicest thing about coming back ever so slightly, just in green rooms and just chatting and just seeing how you are. And it's been, I said it on Twitter the other day, that my friend's joy after doing their first gigs back is my new jam, as they say. Yeah. It's just that you see them on, and it's just, they're just happy, you know.
Oh, it's incredible, like, just to see things sort of getting back to normal a little bit slowly.
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, but, you know, we have to be cautious, don't we? Because it looks, there are other things stopping that, but yeah, do you know what? I'm sick of thinking about it. You know, it gets me anxious.
How have you found, like, from when you started off as a comedian to, like, that's pre-pandemic times, how have you found the sort of the northern sort of comedy circuit? Has it changed drastically? And
yeah, there are some purpose-built venues, and Hot Water over in Liverpool is great, and they're doing good stuff, and the Frog and Bucket and the Comedy Store over here are really good. And then, you know, some of the independent promoters, there's a guy called Rob Riley who puts a lot of stuff on around the north. He's brilliant. I really just work in that kind of M62 corridor, really, across to Leeds and that sort of thing. And then most of my work is, well, most of my income I do, like, by working on the corporate stuff, and that's how I kind of pay for everything. But it's a good circuit, and it's quite supportive. I mean, I don't know what it's like to get on it, and I don't know what it's like at your level to try and get spots. I don't know how easy or how difficult it is, but there's a lot of people doing it, and I think this this time might have wheedled a few out who might need wheedling out.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I think a few of them might have finished now, so.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of vibe with that. But when it comes to, like, your corporate gigs, though, that's what's always interests me, is that, like, is it, how is that compared to going to a normal comedy gig? You go into it, there's a crowd that's come to see you, but then you're doing a corporate gig that might be, I don't know, it could be co-op and all these, like, people that work in an office, and you just got to come on stage. Yeah. How do you sort of, what's the different mindset of that?
People are people, and you know, there are different kinds of, sometimes if it's like an award ceremony and the people are from the same industry, there may be a little bit of fractious between them, but I'm just myself, really. I just, you know, there's certain, you know, you wouldn't, I don't do anything too controversial or too ill thought out. I mean, I'll do new stuff at a corporate, and I'll do stuff about that week and the room and everything else, and that works. But I think I'm quite good at them. I think I'm all right at them. I've always known where the line is and how to get as close to it as I can without, you know, being, you know, upsetting anybody. And that's what I do at these corporates.
So I've got to ask, because this is always a nightmare, and people always ask this, what's been your best gig and what has been your worst gig?
My best gig was at the Hull Truck Theatre before it was rebuilt, and the old Hull Truck Theatre in Spring Street in Hull. I'd sold it out, it was about 300 people in. I was on tour, about my second or third tour. It was the day of the Wimbledon final, and I listened to that on the way over. The sun was shining, and I had a great show. It was a show where I thought, you know, I couldn't put a foot wrong. It was, you know, I was in my pomp. The show was great. Thank you very much. You know, bows, cheers, clapping, thank you, audience. Go off. And at the time, I used to smoke. And I came off stage, and I went, and there was like at the back of the dressing rooms, there was a cage where you could stand and have a smoke, which led onto the car park. And I was having a cigarette, and all these people, I got like a second sort of wave of thanks as they go into the cars. Oh, great, cheers, cheers. I was like, no problem, thank you, cheers, good night, good night. And it was like, so it was like the Wimbledon finals, so it was midsummer, so it was still light, you know, it was about 9:30 on a Sunday night. Put a cigarette out, and as I walked back into the green room, they said, Justin, the stage is clear now if you want to get your stuff. And I walked out, and that room was empty. And all those people that 10 minutes before had loved me had gone. And it killed me. And I understood at that moment why so many comedians turn to drink and drugs and destructive relationships, because we never are happy when that goes. So when that feeling's gone, that feeling of like euphoria, it's temporary, it's just balm. And that, to answer your question, was the best gig and the worst gig all at the same time.
Oh, that was poetic.
Well, that's what it was.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite impressive that you managed to come out of yourself to realise that was, that you could go down that road a little bit, that you can try and replace that feeling with other sense, with other things, and like drugs and things like that, which is, it seems to be quite, I'm not going to say easy for comedians to do that, but it seems to be a road that a lot of it can just happen where you're trying.
Well, there's
to
no responsibilities when you finish work. You're actually in the pub, aren't you? You're at the bar the minute you finish work, and you've got no responsibilities. And often you're away from home. And if you are a family person and you're in a hotel for the night, you'd have to get up in the morning. You know, you're off the leash. You know, people do that sort of thing. And you know, I used to binge drink after gigs, and I've not had a drink now for like more than 5 years. And you know, that's the kind of thing I have to do, and just start driving home, because otherwise I'd just be bladdered and waking up with an hangover and the fear and having to get home then. And you know, I made a practical decision to give up drinking, and that's what I did.
Was that hard? Because in a way, because a lot of comedians that I've noticed that perform often, and they use like drink to sort of get them through.
Yeah, I never did that. I was rubbish on that, because I think it affected my timing, and yeah, you don't want to be out of control when you're doing the thing that you need to be in control for. Hey, with the jokes I'm writing, it's heaven machinery. You shouldn't be operating stuff like that without being a clear-headed person.
Handle with care.
Yeah. So that's it wasn't too difficult, to be honest with you. It wasn't, you know, impossible to deal with.
So I've got the other thing I was wanting to talk to you a little bit about was So you got into this when you were 29, and it just seemed to be like 18 months, it just sort of happened. And like from the outside, that seems like such a fairy tale for some people. Some people could be sat here, like listening to this right now and being like, I'm just a bit older, I'm a bit younger, and like, I want that. Like, what advice can you give to make that happen in this like day and age?
For a stand-up comedian or for anybody, do you mean, or...?
I guess for a stand-up comedian, then, if there's any advice that could go for universal.
Well, I think like that is if you've got a dream, it the worst thing is not to pursue it. The worst thing is to the world is full of coulda beens and woulda beens and shoulda beens. You know, it's better to try it and fail at it, and at least you know then, don't you? At least you know you had it, you gave it a go. For something like stand-up comedy, which is so all-encompassing, which is so takes over your life so much, you've got to want it. And not even want it, you have to need it. And if you don't, then you're wasting your time because, you know, there's some comedians that do it for a hobby and it's just like, oh, for fuck's sakes, you know. Get off the stage, you know what I mean? Get off the stage because you're blocking. You're blocking people that are coming through and, you know, if you're hungry enough for it, you'll have a go at it. And it might not work out. And it's worked out for me to a level, but I've still got that thing of going, why haven't I got this and why am I not there? It took me a long time not to bemoan other people's success, you know, some indication that I was missing out. They're not taking it off me. They've made their own path, you know. So that's what I do. And I'm still ambitious, still hungry, still keen, still learning, still getting better. I think I'm a better comedian now than I was 5 years ago, much better than I was 10 years ago. And, you know, hopefully that'll be the same again in 5 years. I don't think I've peaked.
But, and that's what, clearly not. Clearly it's always like, you always seem to be on tour, you always seem to be working at it. So it's, like you said, it's a muscle. So you're just going to get bigger comedy muscles, surely. But did you always have that funny...
Comedy erection.
I mean, that should be the title of this podcast, really. But were you always funny? Were you that kid at school that was always like making people laugh and stuff?
Same as everybody. All my mates are funny. All my family's funny. Everyone's funny. I was the mouthy one. That's the difference. And I was the one that would take the joke further. And I was the first to push it. But, you know, I know funnier people in real life than me. Doesn't mean they can be good stand-up comedians. Mm. You know? It's like...
So you shouldn't let that stop. If you're not that funny in real life, don't let it stop you. You could be a great stand-up comedian.
But it's like footballers, isn't it? You know what I mean? We all went to school with somebody who was brilliant at football but wouldn't make it because they didn't have everything else.
Yeah.
Just being funny isn't enough. You have to have everything else that goes with it. You know, unless you're some kind of maverick genius. But then those people are deeply unhappy often.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because the pressure of it, I guess, constantly to be at that level. But Justin, thanks so much for popping on the podcast.
Thank you. Every time I enjoyed it.
Oh, it's been great. I barely had to say anything.
Like a therapy session.
Yeah, I felt it. I felt a tension relief. Whenever we have someone on, we always get them to... we always ask them that if Manchester were somehow to divide from the rest of Europe, this isn't Brexit, but just to become its own entity, who would you want to elect as this leader of this brilliant new Manchester world?
Practical answers or fantasy answers or...
You can go for fantasy,
I tell you what
mate.
I would definitely do. I'll tell you what I'd definitely do. I would make it, if we. So the first time it happened, I'd make it a female-only role.
Nice.
So I would make it I would deliberately and, you know, shortlist only women. And I think we'd take the pick of that. There are some fantastic people that are qualified to do it already. But, I mean, if you're looking for some kind of spiritual leader or some kind of, person like that, then maybe Mark Radcliffe. He could do it, couldn't he?
Yeah,
as a kind of honorary president, he could do that. And then, you know, just get some ballsy woman from business, you know, or, you know, to... Maxine Peake, that's who I'd put in for the first one.
Yeah. There we go.
And just a one-year term, that's all you can do, and then somebody else has got to do it. Because, you know, power corrupts and all that.
That was the most well-thought-out answer we've ever had to that. Normally people just go, Bez, and then that's it.
That would be ridiculous, wouldn't it? That would be absolutely ridiculous. Bez, we've got a pandemic crisis. What are you doing? Just some freaky dancing. Just seeing what I do.
I got bees now, mate. I don't need to worry about you lot. I got bees on top of Arndale. And the other thing we always ask is, if you had one word to describe Manchester, what mm-hmm. would you go for?
Just one word. Creative.
I love it. Thanks so much, Justin. That's great.
Thank you.